It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Ever tried elk stroganoff? Well, it's one of the new offerings at Lambeau Field concession stands. We'll hear about all the new foods this year at the Frozen Tundra.
Right now, it's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. There's still fallout from last week's debt ceiling deal between President Trump and Democrats in Congress. Tax reform is on the agenda, and a growing list of Senate Democrats are signing on to a single-payer health care bill.
And Florida is recovering from Hurricane Irma with help from FEMA and faith organizations. And questions continue to be raised about President Trump's business holdings and whether customers at Trump resorts are hoping to buy some influence.
Paul Singer is a Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob. How are you?
Well, good. Let's start with this debt ceiling deal. About a week ago today, President Trump, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi came up with this debt ceiling slash hurricane relief plan. What have we been hearing from, in particular, Republicans since that happened?
Yeah, this is funny because we had spent much of the last week of August preparing for this onslaught of September, where Congress had all of these things they had to do by the end of the month. They had to get hurricane funding done. They had to get spending bills done to keep the government open. They had to raise the debt ceiling. And we had assigned all these reporters and had this whole strategy. And then, like on a Thursday afternoon, they just did it. kicked the entire thing to December. Republicans were caught completely off guard by this, and to some degree, they were enraged. I mean, when the idea of this package was first floated early in the day, whatever day it was, I've lost track of my days, House Speaker Paul Ryan said it's ridiculous. And 2 hours later, Donald Trump was basically announcing the deal from the White House. So he caught a lot of Republicans blindsided, and their frustration here is that the spending bill and the debt ceiling are supposed to be, for them, opportunities to negotiate with some leverage for significant spending cuts. Well, Trump didn't do any of that with this deal. There were no spending cuts in it. And now we kick it back to December, when it's almost impossible for the Republicans to actually threaten a government shutdown. And so they'll have no leverage at all to demand spending cuts. They are very upset.
And then the other big Republican item after health care didn't end up happening was a tax system overhaul. And now last night and today, President Trump meeting with selected Democrats on taxes, Democrats and Republicans today. I think here's a quick listen to the president kicking off today's meeting.
More and more we're trying to work things out together. That's a positive thing, and it's good for the Republicans and good for the Democrats, and this group knows that very well. Whether we can do the incredible things that we're doing and working in a bipartisan fashion obviously would be a positive, and I think something, Tom, that we all feel good about.
Now, going back to the primary, I remember Ted Cruz and others raising the red flag that President Trump was going to cut deals with Democrats if he was elected. Are they? Is there any kind of I told you so's going on behind the scenes?
Oh, yeah. You know, there has been a longstanding concern amongst conservatives, longstanding conservatives in Washington, that Donald Trump is not one of them. He is a populist and a nationalist, but he is not an ideological conservative. I will tell you that half an hour before I came on your show, we just moved a breaking news alert that Trump announced after his meeting with these Democrats that they have on the table the possibility of raising taxes on the rich.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, that was not on the Republican agenda.
It's apostasy to the Republicans. I mean, that's the stuff we don't do, right? I mean, these people have all pledged no new taxes, right? There's literally the tax cut pledge of Grover Norquist's group that says, with the National Taxpayers Union, that we will not raise taxes. Well, Donald Trump just said, maybe we will.
Are Democrats getting really excited here, or are they thinking, okay, today the president's working with us on the debt ceiling, maybe he's working on taxes? Is this all kumbaya and hugs and kisses here?
No, I mean, the trouble that President Trump has set for himself here is that no one knows what tomorrow's version of Donald Trump's going to look like. And so while I think that there is some enthusiasm amongst the Democrats for the deal that they got on the debt ceiling and the spending bill, and they have some enthusiasm that he's now talking about a tax package they might like, he's interested in some infrastructure stuff they might like, he might even be willing to open to a deal on health care. It's hard to tell. You just don't know what's going to happen tomorrow when he talks to somebody else. And until it's actually signed, sealed, delivered, and passed by the Congress, I don't think anybody is celebrating a victory yet.
We're looking at the latest in national politics with Paul Singer from USA Today. And, Paul, some health care news. Senator Bernie Sanders unveiled a single-payer health care proposal. He's got 15 Democrats signing on, which they didn't used to do. I want to listen to some dueling Sanderses here. First of all, Bernie Sanders speaking today.
We begin the long and difficult struggle to end the international disgrace of the United States, our great nation, being the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all of our people.
Then White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders, no relation, I believe, responding to Senator Bernie Sanders.
Not only does the president not support it, but America doesn't support it, or Bernie Sanders would be sitting in the Oval Office right now. He pushed these ideas forward during the campaign. They were rejected, not just by America, but Democrats. He didn't make it through the primary. He didn't make it into the Oval. I think that's a pretty clear indication of what America wants to see, and it's not a single-payer system.
So a bunch of Democrats signing on, Paul, where they hadn't been so ready to do so in the past. What do you make of that?
Politics, politics, politics. Sarah Sanders is right. This is not a broadly supported bill, and by the way, the U.S. Congress is almost certainly not going to pass it. However, it is also true that the Democrats have figured out that they don't, it's not clear to Americans what they stand for. It's not clear what their agenda is. And so a bunch of Democrats, particularly ones who might want to run for president in 2020, are now trying to get their arms around Bernie Sanders and his agenda in a big bear hug. So that's where you see people like, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand embracing this, the senator from New York. That's where you see Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, embracing this. This is a proposal that Hillary Clinton was not ready to embrace. And in fact, Nancy Pelosi has said that she wants to focus on fixing the Affordable Care Act first. But this is red meat for the Democratic primary voter, or at least the one that Bernie Sanders seemed to really inspire last time. So Democrats want to be there.
I want to look at another potential piece of legislation. This one may be bipartisan. Transgender military bill. We had you just mentioned Senator Kirsten Gillibrand from New York on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, Senator Susan Collins trying to put in an amendment in a defense authorization bill that would effectively block the White House from banning transgender service members from serving. Is that something that you think the Senate would have an appetite to do?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I doubt it. In part because President Trump's policy at the moment is in such murky status. Basically, the president issued this policy in a tweet. I'm sure your listeners remember this a couple of weeks ago, saying that nobody transgender should serve in the military, but he hadn't talked to the Pentagon about it yet. And so what they did was basically create a task force to sort of go sort this all out. And what the Pentagon has said is, we're going to leave our current policy in place. No new transgender soldiers will be enrolled until we figure this out. But for the time being, anybody currently serving can continue to serve until we figure it out. So, you know, I am, there is still a very strong Republican base that is very upset about the sort of decline of traditional American values, particularly faith-based values, and they're going to continue to fight against the expanded opportunities for transgender soldiers. So I don't think yet that the Republican Congress is going to be willing to roll that back, but it makes for an interesting argument.
We're looking at the top stories in national politics with Paul Singer from USA Today. Still to come, faith, FEMA, and hurricane recovery.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more cooperation between President Trump and congressional Democrats on issues like a tax system overhaul? A lot of Democratic senators are signing onto a single-payer health care proposal. Do you think that's a good idea? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Paul Singer is with us from USA Today, and we're looking at some of the big news in national politics.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. We were just talking about single-payer health care, some Democratic senators getting on board where they didn't before. Is that a good idea in terms of policy, in terms of politics? Do you want to see more cooperation between President Trump and congressional Democrats? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. We've got Jeff with us in Franksville. Jeff, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think?
Well, I believe in a one-payer system. In fact, I'd like to see all Americans have the same coverage as our elected representatives in Washington. And what I wanted to comment on is to ask your guest if there's any information or to see what he thinks if it were a one-issue election based on single-payer health care, would there be a Republican in the Oval Office right now?
Jeff, thanks for the call. I mean, Obamacare was almost a single issue in 2010. Paul, can we learn lessons from that for what a single-payer election might look like?
I don't know. I mean, the trouble, of course, as your caller, Jeff, would recognize is that Obamacare was extraordinarily unpopular public policy, but the Affordable Care Act was not.
And, of course, they were the same thing. Yes.
They were the same thing. So it's hard to know at any given moment whether Americans are sufficiently focused on the policy and how it affects them, or they are just affected by the rhetoric and the advertising. Unfortunately, there's no really such thing as a single-issue election, and whatever that issue is would no longer matter anyway if there was, God forbid, some sort of terrorist attack on our soil, you know. So it's just hard to know. It is very clear that from the repeal effort that the Republicans mounted, that repealing Obamacare has not proven to be nearly as popular as Obamacare was unpopular. So it's, you know, once people actually have a benefit like that, they kind of like it.
Thanks for the call. Go next to Jacob in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Jacob?
So I'm a registered nurse, and then just from the healthcare level, insurance, I waste so much of my time, and so many others do in healthcare, dealing with insurance and prior authorization, when I think a single-payer system would allow us to spend a lot more time and energy correctly taking care of the patient. Additionally, I think if there was a single-payer, then people would have more freedom in this country. I've heard dozens of stories of people being held back by their current situation because they have to do this, that, or the other thing just to have health care for their families and themselves.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Senator Bernie Sanders talking today raised some similar issues and also said, as I understand it, look, this might result in higher taxes, but you won't be paying money to insurance companies. You won't spend your time filling out paperwork. Life is going to be easier and more convenient for patients. And Jacob saying for healthcare providers, Paul.
Yeah, well, there was a study out just a couple of days ago that said something like 60% of their time, healthcare providers say they spend 60% of their time on paperwork and forms. I honestly would not swear that would be different under a single-payer system because, again, if it's going to be government-run, government-funded, there will still be an enormous amount of paperwork to manage it, at the advantage being that it would be one set of paperwork instead of different paperwork for every insurer. I think the other thing for single-payer that is an advantage is that obviously it makes it easier for people to get wellness care, that is, preventive care. You just walk in and get it, in theory. One of the issues is you are talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's not clear how you pay for that. So that is sort of where the at least one point of dissension. And the other is going to be, if it's government-run healthcare, will you be able to get the healthcare you want, or will you have to wait, or will you be limited in the choices you have?
take one more caller. Thanks for that, Jacob. But one more caller on single payer. Russ is with us in Bristol. Russ, hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you think?
It's a no-brainer. The politicians keep monkeying around with the whole, how do we pay for it? How do we not pay for it? You have to go single payer. They're all about risk pools. The Affordable Health Care Act was about risk pools. Well, they're talking about risk pools of 10, 100 people. You've got 340 million people that live here in America. If you go single payer, you've got a 340 million pool. There's no risk. Therefore, your cost actually goes down.
Gotcha. Russ, thanks a lot for the call. I want to move on to another caller now on taxes, I think. Linda is with us in Chambers Island. Linda, hi.
Hi. Well, I never heard anything in the campaign about lowering taxes for the rich people, and all of a sudden, that's all we heard about. Now we're hearing about raising taxes for rich people. Aren't we all for that? You know, they have so much money, they don't know what to do with it.
Linda, thanks for the call. Paul, what did we hear on tax policy in the campaign?
Well, President Trump's tax policies have been vague but pretty consistent that he wants to reduce the number of tax brackets and lower the highest tax brackets by significant percentages. And again, this is one of those questions of, well, it's going to be a $1 trillion giveaway, particularly to the rich and to corporations. At various times, the president has said, well, yeah, but we're going to pay for it by reducing some of the write-offs, some of the deductions, some of the loopholes by which people avoid taxes. And so it'll be kind of a wash. And at various times, some people amongst his cabinet have suggested that closing those loopholes might actually end up raising the taxes on the rich. But I have to just warn everybody here, we have never at any point in this process seen any real specifics about what is in this tax package, what the president would support and wouldn't support, and what he needs to see. So, you know, until we have numbers on paper, it's really hard for us to know what is really at offering here. But we know the president wants to reduce taxes. He says he wants to make a dramatic tax reduction, particularly on the middle class. And we hear today that maybe that would include an increase in taxes for the wealthy.
Thanks for your call. We're talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the big stories in national politics. Paul, I want to turn to a couple stories, actually, that you've covered at USA Today. First of all, of course, we've got cleanup going on from Hurricane Irma in Florida, Hurricane Harvey in Texas. And you wrote a piece about the huge role that faith organizations are playing in recovery and generally play in disaster recovery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what people don't recognize about this, and I frankly didn't know it myself until I really dug into it, is that you know, when FEMA deploys in a disaster area, they deploy along with a whole bunch of nonprofits, large national nonprofits that have major disaster recovery operations. There are truckloads of food being delivered by faith organizations, one called the Convoy of Hope in Missouri, for instance. You know, they will set up a feeding station at FEMA's sort of direction, or at least organize with FEMA. They will staff the feeding operation. The Seventh-day Adventists are experts in warehousing for disaster relief supplies. So when FEMA says, hey, you know, all these disaster relief supplies are arriving from donors and volunteers around the country, where should we put it? The Adventists are where you put it. They know how to set up a big warehouse and run it for FEMA. Someone told me that 80% of disaster recovery will be operated and provided by nonprofit organizations, and 75% of those are faith-based organizations. It's amazing what size of the infrastructure they make up for disaster recovery.
And it was, I had no idea, as you said, you know, the Adventists have their warehouse specialty. A lot of different denominations or religions have their own disaster relief specialty areas.
Yeah, I'm told that the Southern Baptists have the third largest disaster recovery organization in the country. The United Methodists have 20,000 volunteers already in a list, already in a system that can be called up for disaster recovery. And they specialize in various different areas so that they're not stepping on each other's toes. What you don't want, and some of what happened in Katrina, was, you know, you had a feeding tent across the street from another feeding tent by two different organizations. That's no help. So FEMA actually invites these groups into the emergency command headquarters in Washington in the middle of these storms. So while Irma was going on, we were actually over there watching them in their response headquarters, and the faith-based groups were sitting there with the FEMA people organizing the response.
And you've mentioned a few different Christian denominations. Other religions are at the table, too.
Oh, yeah. The Buddhists tell me they're going to give out $5 million worth of gift cards for retail so that disaster victims can go to a retail store and buy things they might need, clothes or food. There's a Jewish cleanup operation that goes and helps people clean out their homes. There's a Muslim disaster relief. It's called something like Islamic National Response Team or something like that. So, it's every faith group. There's also non-faith groups, and there are groups that do this that are non-faith. But it is faith groups of every stripe and in numbers far more significant than we understood.
And finally, Paul, USA Today investigation looked at who's buying memberships at various Trump Organization-owned resorts. Why was that something you tackled?
Well, the White House is no longer releasing visitor records, that is, visitors to the White House. And they're also not releasing the names of visitors to Donald Trump's golf resorts where President Trump spends a lot of time. And we thought it would be worth asking the question, who is he potentially meeting with? Who are some of the folks who are at these resorts, who are members, who can have access to the president? Because you've seen all this stuff on Instagram, and he goes and he hangs out and he chats people on the golf course and he goes to their weddings. So we dug through social media and other public records and found people who had declared their membership in the Trump golf clubs. And it would not surprise you, we found a bunch of rich people. We also found people who were lobbyists, who work for companies that have interests before the president's administration. And these people are now paying $100,000 or $200,000 to be a member of a club that Donald Trump owns so that they can be at the club when Donald Trump shows up. And maybe they can talk to him about what's business. Now, they all tell, the ones we reached told us, we never talk business. It's just about the golf. But we thought it's worth, and we'll continue to pursue, worth seeing whether, in fact, business is being conducted on Donald Trump's golf courses by people who are paying to be there to see Donald Trump.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks for joining us, as always.
Thanks, Rob. You be well.
You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today, joining us for our weekly roundup of national politics.